Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, tackling homeless with the help of an NFL legend. We talk with Leroy Butler about his local advocacy and the growing challenge of serving the homeless. Later, a new reef creation project barges in off the First Coast. But first, meeting the needs of those experiencing or on the verge of homelessness is a problem that seems to grow by the day. The nonprofit Changing Homelessness is on the front lines of that challenge and tonight celebrates 50 years in Jacksonville. Here to talk about the event and the work is Jacksonville native, former Green Bay Packers safety and Hall of Famer Leroy Butler. Welcome.
Thank you, Ann, for having me.
It's a delight.
For us, not just me.
Thanks for all of you for being here. We're also joined by Don Gilman, the CEO of Changing Homelessness.
Happy to be here.
And you want Alan here to along for the ride?
Along for the ride today, yeah, because you're here. That's the reason I'm here.
That's more than enough. Thank you for being here, Ioana. It's
just
great to see you.
Don't make her laugh, please.
Thank you.
Because it's a good laugh, we should say.
Yes.
A beloved laugh.
I appreciate that.
Leroy, for those who don't know, your football career actually started here in Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. Remind us how you came up. You played at Lehigh, which
yes.
is now Riverside.
Riverside, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think for me, if you understand how tough it was for poverty growing up in the Blodgett homes, if you're from Jacksonville, Florida, you're going to be familiar with some of these names, but stayed across the street from Jefferson Street Pool. My mom raised five kids by herself, and I was a disabled kid and special needs. But for some reason, God said, you want to play in the NFL? I said, well, who am I going to tell that to? And I told it to the family, and I was going to Hope Haven Children's Hospital. And they said, well, his feet are kind of pigeon-toed. He may have to wear some braces, and we have to put him in cast and stuff like that. But so growing up, to me, my heroes were people that my grandmother always talked about were my teachers, because kids picked on me from wearing hand-me-downs. And, I never got invited to sleepovers, never went to the mall and stuff like that. And I remember my grandmother saying, God gave everybody a talent. And I didn't know what she was talking about, because if you're a kid and you get picked on a lot, you don't think you have any talent. And then she said, no, you have a great talent, because nothing negative bothers you. And that's when she told me the real heroes help people who they don't know. And as a young kid, you hear that, that shaped my whole thinking. And that's why working with Changes Homelessness means something to me, because when you're growing up in extreme poverty, and sometimes you can be middle of the road, one or two paychecks from being out, to one day it may be somebody in a room discussing policy to put somebody in prison because they can't afford to live in a nice place. That kind of anxiety is the reason why we do events like tonight. But me as a person, Fort Caroline Junior High, I almost went to Terry Parker. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have time for that story. Went to Lehigh and got with Coach Corky Rogers, and that's when I started feeling that God-given ability to play football.
When you first were coming up, you alluded to the fact that you had some kind of defects with your legs.
Yeah.
You were severely pigeon-toed. You actually had to have your legs broken or your feet broken?
Yeah, the little white corrective shoes, they didn't work for me. They worked for every kid, but not me. So they was like, well, Ms. Butler, he has to go through PT. I didn't know what that was, physical therapy. And she was like, well, if you guys go out to like Disney, which was unheard of, he has to be in a wheelchair because you can't move. Oh, he has to wear these crutches. But my sister was my hero, of course. She just wanted to take the braces off so you can be normal when you're in the home. And I couldn't go to the swimming pool mainly because I couldn't swim, but mainly because I had to wear braces to walk. If you see a penguin or a pelican or any bird just walks, and it's just kind of, that's how it was. Mm-hmm. So it goes all the way up to the hip. So they got to correct that. And pretty much for the most part, it did, but my left foot still was a little pigeon-toed. But so I was never the fastest kid. That's what I tell all kids. It's not really the height and weight. It's just if you can understand what the coaches are telling you and you can play.
So in your early years, you were actually watching kids in the neighborhood
yes.
play football from a wheelchair.
Yes, yes. And from the porch because mainly I like seeing other kids happy. That was my joy. To other people would say, no, if I can't do it, I don't want anybody else to do it. But everybody was out of the house because you go play as a kid, you go play. But I had to stay in because I couldn't do those things. So my favorite uncle, Charles, we call him Uncle Vaughn, he would come by and he would sit there on the porch and he'd say, you know what? I got some VHS tapes and let's go watch some NFL. I said, really? It's baseball season. So we would go to his house and put in, I know some millennial here, they got VHS tapes.
What's that?
Yeah, we have VCRs.
But I would watch the NFL and every day. And they had sign up for the YMCA football. And it was $38. I didn't have it. And my uncle said, if you really want to play, I'll get it for you. And my heart was beating so, because they test you, like how fast can you jump? And the anxiety of not being athletic, I didn't let that bother me because I was so happy to just to be on the field. When you see other kids playing, I never looked up and said, God, okay, why you picked me to be here? Like, can't run and jump. I'd be on the bus and kids would pick on you because my teacher used to come get me. That didn't bother me. What bothered me that I didn't have the opportunity, and my uncle helped me get the opportunity.
You went on to play for the Green Bay Packers.
Yes.
Some may or may not know that you actually originated the Lambeau Leap, which is...
They better know it if they got the internet. That, to me, was 30 years ago last December. And I'll never forget it. And that was my first time being in a cold game because I'm from Duval County. And when I played in that game, it was 20 below. I really thought they were going to forfeit the game. I went over to the thermostat because I'm a diva. Sorry. I used to always check the weather. And it said a minus next to a 20. I'm like, my refrigerator is 32 degrees. We're going to die. He was like, no, we'll give you stuff to keep you warm. And when I got the fumble and I called the fumble. Reggie White picks it up. He laterals it to me. And I'm running down the sideline. I got about the 15-yard line just spontaneously. I said, I'm going to jump in the stands. And I think it's one of the best celebrations because it's not just me. It's the fan base. We have the best fan base because they're owners. We don't have an owner. Well, the Jaguars has an amazing owner that does a lot. But we didn't have an owner, so you can jump up
there. Packers owns the team, the Green Bay
yes,
Packers.
You can buy stock. It's amazing. And so to celebrate with them, I thought was just tremendous. So it's something that we do quite a bit.
It's a great tradition.
Yes.
Don, how did Changing Homelessness connect with Leroy Butler? And what does it mean to have him as, you know, an advocate and a spokesperson?
Well, he is an amazing spokesperson, and has just his excitement, not just with football, but in celebrating Jacksonville and Northeast Florida and trying to make it a better place for everyone. He has been an amazing spokesperson for us as we celebrate our 50 years in the community. So the connection is actually through his former wife, who was the drill coach of Juwanna Allen, who works with us. And it just came about kind of organically, and that he was going to be in town last year when we were, we do an annual volunteer appreciation and State of Homeless breakfast. And he was going to be around and graciously agreed to help us out with that. And then at the breakfast, apparently he had such a good time, he announced he was going to be our ambassador for our 50th year. I have heard all this secondhand because that's when I got COVID. So,
oh, yeah.
she wasn't even there.
So I was not at any of the events.
But she looked amazing on Zoom, though.
So it's, you know, we were founded 50 years ago, very, very grassroots. It was other agencies. It was the downtown churches. It was the people that were working directly with people on the streets throughout the community. And, you know, for many years, we weren't even incorporated. We did not become incorporated until 2001. And that was so we could handle federal grants, right? For the money to be able to come into our community, someone has to be responsible for it. And you have to be recognized by the feds for that. There was actually not an employee of the agency until 2004.
And was that you? Were you the
No, I was. I'm actually the third ED CEO of the agency. So I like to think I've been here the longest. I think I've made the most changes. When I started, there was just me. We now have 85 people. We concentrate in Duval, Clay, and Nassau counties. We are the lead agency for the state. The counties and the feds recognize us there, so we do a lot of real direct work there. We also have a very large grant for veterans that's 17 counties, that is from Daytona Beach up to Savannah, Georgia. So we run the coastal counties that way. So we have changed a lot in 50 years and a lot in the past 15 years. We do most of our direct services either for veterans or in outreach and coordinated intake here in Northeast Florida.
And we needed someone to help us leap into 50 years, thus Butler helping us leap into 50 years. So that's how that whole concept came about in terms of the anniversary itself.
And Yuana, you're the facilitator of that. You brought all that together.
I am. I did. Yes.
You're bragging over there, ain't you?
She asked me a question.
Yeah. No, she don't even like talking about herself, but she was... My grandmother always said God made everybody good at something, and Yuana's just the most organized person I've ever met, and the vision of what she wanted is truly amazing, because if you know my story, and of course Miss G, but she doesn't get a lot of credit, but you're amazing. I'm not trying to make you cry, but I love her. I do. I love her. I love her because she's just very organized. And so that's really helped.
And, you know, when 50th anniversary, I was like, we're a homeless organization, right? Part of the homeless coalition. We should not have some big gala. It's got to be something that can really connect. And she came up with the idea of a sneaker ball.
Platinum.
So it is the Homes for All sneaker ball is happening tonight. And so you can... Literally, if you wish to show up in your tennies and a tracksuit, come on down. If you want to wear a big fluffy gown in your tennis shoes, that's okay too.
Plastic black tie or tracksuit fly.
Or tracksuit fly. Yeah.
Come as you are. We just want you to come.
That's awesome.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with NFL legend Leroy Butler about tonight's 50th anniversary celebration of Changing Homelessness. You can join our conversation on air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or reach out on social media. The work of addressing homelessness has also changed.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, Leroy, if when you come back to Jacksonville, it looks different in terms of the problem, if it's becoming more visible.
Yeah, it is. 'Cause when I originally came back and the Blodgett homes were torn down and they kind of reconstructed it. And we're doing a documentary on my life story.
For people who don't know, I mean, that was a troubled, it was a public housing project.
Yes, yes, ma'am.
That had some, I mean, it was had some crime problems. It had
to say the least.
Maintenance problems.
Everything. I mean, we used to have this saying that Cabrini Green in Chicago and the Blodgett homes are two of the housing projects. Crime and just out of control that people would avoid. And they said, wait a minute, you made it out of the Blodgett homes? And I'm like, yes. Even like my older kids, I would take them by. I said, oh, that's not where it was. We had the original pictures in my book. And
because the new Blodgett homes looks very different.
Oh, yeah. That's the suburbs compared to this. because it was just a place that, like my mom said, somebody's going to come out of here and do something great. But, and then she gave me this amazing quote. She said, to be a leader, you must once had to be a good follower. But if you're going to follow, choose the right leaders. And I said, Mom, that's deep. I'm only like 9. You drill that down. Teachers, police officers, first responders, people like that. People who help people who they don't know. Because it could be families right now at Changing Homelessness that we don't know, but we're going to help them. That's why we have to have events like this. And that's how I grew up. And I'm so proud of that. Because I do know some athletes who grew up in the inner city, they don't like discussing it because they don't want people to know it. I always tell people about Duval and how I was raised. I mean, grew up in the Blige home because I represent those people.
The problem of homelessness, Don, you're celebrating 50 years, but it is a time where we're seeing an increase really in, you know, across the country in the problem of homelessness, the lack of availability of affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly something that I think people can sense just driving around the city.
It's much more visible and it has grown. How I like when I do any kind of public speaking, I like to start with the statement that homelessness as we know it today in America is a solvable problem. And while we do see more people who are forced to live on the streets in Northeast Florida now than we have in quite some time, it's still a relatively small number. It's a small enough number that it is solvable. But like you said, it takes building what we call attainable or deeply affordable housing. That's usually housing with a subsidy, and the people to help people get back in and sustain that housing. Usually something has happened that's forced someone out of their home. It could be, very often it's a health incident, a loss of a partner or spouse. There's been some sort of shock to the system, and sometimes people need a little bit extra support. So when we raise money outside of what our governmental grants give us, it's to add in all those other things that maybe are not covered by a grant to make sure that we can provide all of the wraparound services that are needed.
What kind of services are there? I mean, what else is needed besides just the housing for this?
That's a good question.
So there's a couple different things. If you look at a group of us that work in this have written for the current administration, what's the 5-year plan to end homelessness? What would it take? You need folks that go out and engage with people who are literally homeless, that are able to meet them where they are, to rebuild that trust and that connection so they will be willing to come back in. We need a place for them to go immediately, right? If someone's willing to come in today, where can they go today? Right now, it's often very hard. If someone's ready to go, we may not have a shelter bed that's accessible to them on that day. And we also need a pathway either directly off the street or from that transitional temporary housing into something that's permanent for them. It may be something in our sector, we call it rapid rehousing. That's a short-term housing subsidy, and we're building up the household income. They hold the lease, and eventually that temporary assistance goes away because the family's going to maintain their own housing. There's about, 10 to 20% of folks who are on the street that need something more that we call permanent supportive housing. These are folks that have some sort of diagnosed disability. They've been on the streets for a year or more. They need more intensive wraparound services, and they need to get those services probably within their own home where they feel safe and secure. So it's when we look at the different components of it, as I like to say, we're not doing a manned mission to Mars, right? We need the database to know who's where and what and how are we connecting them and how are we braiding the funding. We need outreach to go out and talk to people. We need coordinated entry to refer people to where they need to go. And then we need things like emergency shelter, transitional housing, rapid rehousing, and permanent supportive housing. Different things for different people. It's it's very rarely a, we call it a one and done, right? Mm-hmm. Where you just give someone a little bit of money and then they're good. They can go back. There are a few people like that. We try to catch them early to bounce them up and out. But usually it takes a little bit more to get someone fully out of homelessness where they can sustain and maintain housing for themselves.
And we did a program recently. Actually, I want to take a couple of calls. I'm going to interrupt myself. I don't want to leave these people hanging. We got a call from Eric in Arlington. Good morning, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah, real quick. First of all, I really enjoyed your guest's football career. It was always a point of pride for me to be watching a football game and Leroy Butler would do something great on the field and I could turn to people and say, yeah, he's from Jacksonville. As a person who's lived in Jacksonville for since he was 5 years old, it's a point of pride for me when people do good from here. Two questions, and you don't have to answer them if you don't want to. In 2020, there was the George Floyd controversy in which a lot of professional player, NFL players, NBA players, and so on, chose to make a stand, and or actually the opposite. They kneeled during the national anthem and basically chose to be involved in this political event, I guess you'd say. So my first question for you is, do you think that's the right place? I personally do, but do you think that's the right place for athletes? Do you think athletes should be involved politically? And my second question is for your other guest, and that is it frustrating for you when you're out there working and you have a governor in the state of Florida who's actively working against you? You know, for instance, I mean, I could think of many, many, many examples, but the most glaring one is the $3.5 billion Medicaid expansion, which DeSantis has refused. And that's money for poor people to get their teeth fixed, to get health care when they got cancer, and so on and so forth. So is it frustrating for you as an organization to have, you know, people working against you?
Thanks, Eric. Thanks. Let's start with you, Leroy.
Yeah, I think, first of all, thanks for the compliment and the support. I think that's truly amazing. Anytime you protest anything, it's going to be uncomfortable for somebody. But when you're free, you're free. And I think that's the good thing about it is we can't have it both ways. I know this is leap year when everybody wants to vote and make things politics. But I think for the most part, I don't mind a guy, just like the young man from Kansas City, who said that's his view. I don't have a problem with that because everybody just has to have opinion on what they live by, what's their religion. We can all live here. We don't have to always agree, but respectfully, see, the politician is supposed to go after each other. But as Americans, we can agree to disagree, just like the barbershop. People disagree, but if we both get our hair cut, it's fine. I have people on both sides of the aisle. I have people who knelt, people who didn't, but the game still goes on. But ultimately, it's to bring attention to something that we all can work on so we all can live in a most beautiful place like America.
And Dawn, about the governor, the question.
I'm going to have a remarkably similar response to Mr. Butler over there. Governors in Florida get to serve for 8 years. We've been around for 50. It is my job to work with whomever is in office on the local, state, and federal level. It is also my job to educate not only our elected officials, but also our citizens on what are different things that can work to help solve the problem. The caller, Eric, brought up Medicaid, Medicare expansion. That did amazing things during COVID when more people were able to access that funding, that medical help. It's important for citizens and electeds to know one of the leading causes for people to fall into homelessness is medical debt. That is a real thing. So anytime we have an opportunity to expand access and funding for that, we have to look at it closely. With all things, there is a cost to it. But as I also remind a lot of electeds, there's a cost to doing nothing. So we have to weigh both of that. I will say that for the most part, homelessness and ending homelessness has remained a bipartisan issue. Across the aisle, yeah. conservative or more liberal, no one, I have run into no one that believes a fellow human being should be forced to sleep on the streets, right? So as Leroy said, we can have a difference of opinion on how to get there, but I can work with your why.
Exactly.
If your why is to end homelessness, let's figure out where our overlap is and work with that.
Got a message, Tiffany, from Facebook. She says, amazing story on how a family can be instrumental in placing a child on another path. Family is so important. We have a call. Curtis mm-hmm. on the north side. Good morning, Curtis. Go ahead. We just have a couple minutes left.
Okay. Thank you, Ann. Good morning. Ann, you do a beautiful job, my sister. Mr. Butler, brother, that is an inspirational story. A story of perseverance. Brother, everyone should be able to hear that. It doesn't matter what their tax bracket is. That is so inspiring, man. That is beautiful, brother. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you so much. It also means a lot that the impact of helping people like tonight. Now, and I'm going to win the shoe cam, best shoes.
You're
tonight.
Sure of that?
Yes, but this Miss G and Joanna have disqualified me.
As you should be.
Okay.
As you should be.
So I'll just be a judge.
Okay.
And I'll be fair.
What are you going to be? What are you being displaying tonight on the?
I don't want to give away what I want.
Just give us a sneak peek.
Well, I have three types that I'm going to wear. Thank you for asking. I have a brand new LeBron James shoe that nobody has seen. Okay. Nobody. And I also have a Skecher that Snoop Dogg sent me personally. And I have some old school Jordans that I'm going to wear. So I don't want to give it away.
Are you changing shoes like several times?
Hey, don't be trying to peek behind the
camera. He already said he was a diva, so I'm going to go with it. Yeah, I expect all three. Absolutely. All three shoes tonight.
There are not many tickets left. Is that right? You want
to? There's not many tickets left. Yeah. If you are interested in coming to the ball, you need to go to our website. It's changinghomelessness.org and purchase your tickets. If you cannot make it, still go to the site and give. We would appreciate that. This effort, this ball, is really about making investment in our community. And we appreciate all gifts. No gift is too small.
Well, you want it, Alan, Leroy Butler, Dawn Gilman. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us. Always good to see you.
Great show.
All right. And up next, we head under the sea to explore the underwater ruins of man-made reefs. Welcome back. Early last month, a massive barge sunk off the coast of Northeast Florida, and it was no accident. The vessel joins a few others as part of an ongoing artificial reef creation effort. To talk about it, I'm joined by Joe Kistel, visual media producer specializing in underwater cinematography and maker of many of these reefs.
That's right.
Thanks for being here, Joe.
Thank you for the opportunity.
We're also joined by Dr. Quentin White, executive director of the Marine Research Institute and professor of biology and marine science at Jacksonville University for a little bit longer.
I'll make a minor correction. It's a former executive director. I'm retiring August 31st, and Brian Franks has now taken over the executive director position. So right. I'm on the cruising part of my career. So
short timer. Well, thanks for being here, Dr. White. Joe, you've been at this for a while. You are involved in basically sinking ships, massive ships, barges offshore. How'd you get started in this line of work?
Kind of by accident. I went to University of North Florida and I had an interest in scuba diving. When I was a young child, I grew up fishing and scuba diving in South Florida. I was kind of introduced to artificial reefs down there. So I started an appreciation. At the time, I didn't know how they got there. I just knew they were fishing at diving locations. So when I was up here in Jacksonville, I started diving with a local dive group and then came across this opportunity where I heard that there was a vessel that was available maybe for sinking. And so I just assumed somebody was dealing with that. And I got into the project and learned real quick that this vessel was almost no longer an opportunity. And I was like, well, hey, let's make this happen. It could be a good thing. But I just assumed that there was organizations, either the county or other groups, that were dealing with it. And what I found out, long story short, is that there were multiple organizations somewhat interested, but they all assumed the other organization was doing the project. So we got through that project and at the time realized there really wasn't a central organization to deal with that. So we formed an organization called TSERI to kind of spearhead these types of marine habitat creation projects.
And remind us what TSERI stands for.
TSERI stands for Think It, Sink It, Reef It.
Mm-hmm. And so the benefits of reef creation, Dr. White, I mean, Joe talks about scuba diving. Obviously, that's, you know, a tourism attraction and an economic benefit of its own kind. But from a marine standpoint, what do these reefs bring to the marine environment? And how is this not just like pollution in the ocean?
Yeah. Well, offshore Jacksonville, we have sort of two kinds of bottoms, if you would, what we call live bottom and dead bottom. The live bottom is hard surfaces, rocky outcroppings, things like that. And they hold fish because they've got food, they've got resources. There's also a large amount of sand bottom out there, soft bottom, that doesn't tend to be quite as productive biologically. And we learned back, frankly, during the war, World War II primarily, that when planes or ships went down, that they quickly managed to acquire growth. We call it fouling communities because it was barnacles and bryozoans and crabs and worms and things like that. And that's food for the fish. And began to realize that we could actually enhance the fishing offshore Jacksonville if we created these artificial reefs. So this has been done for quite literally centuries back to the Chinese and Japanese who started doing it years and years ago. And so we have done that primarily through volunteer effort. I got involved when I first got to Jacksonville back in the 70s, and then other friends of Joe's and mine have sort of carried it on, but it's always been done by volunteers. It's too bad we don't really have a government program here in the county to do it.
I was thinking about what it would take to coordinate this effort. I was kind of joking that Joe must be incredibly organized to pull it all together, but I mean, from a regulatory standpoint, from a, you know, funding standpoint, I mean, I'm not sure which of you wants to take this, but it seems like there must be an enormous amount of agencies and participants and stakeholders that have to be involved.
Yeah, so I approach it from kind of a bias side. I'm personally aware of the benefits of these, and not everybody is, but I at least personally feel that it is worthwhile to do whatever we can to make marine habitat locations. And so my aim is to kind of just do whatever it takes, facilitate wherever. And there's a lot of pieces to that. There's regulatory. There's certain rules on what we can use, what sort of condition it has to be in, and where it can go. Just to deal with that is several steps. We got to pick a location. Is it permitted? Do we have to pull a permit? There's all these different things to pull a permit. We have to find acceptable material. Generally, my approach is to find something we can recycle. So this way, we're not utilizing any resources to make something new. We're going to take something and recycle it in maybe a not traditional way that the material could potentially normally be recycled. Then if we find all that stuff, if we get the okay and the regulatory, we still have logistics. If it's generally these materials are heavy, it's either an old vessel and or it's concrete. Well, both are heavy and they're hard to transport. So there's usually cost and those types of things. So there's definitely a lot of pieces. There's a lot of red tape and it takes a long time. But from my personal standpoint, when we see these projects after they've been in the water a few years, it's funny, every time I start one, I'm like, I'm never doing this again, because it is a nightmare to try to pull this off. But when you go dive it a couple years later and you see what it turns into, it's so gratifying to see that this underwater oasis that's created simply by, it's not simple, by placing something that potentially could have been trash otherwise.
And you do have to go through a fairly rigorous process to prepare a vessel in terms of removing things like the fluids and the electronics and anything that could be a contamination it basically has to be just a metal husk.
Yeah, and that's a simple way to look at it. Essentially, our kind of approach is if it's not metal, we take it out. And we just sunk this barge in May. A nice thing about the barge is the barge was never self-propelled. It never had an engine or anything like that. So in this case, it was relatively clean, no fuels or anything like that. On a traditional vessel, like an old tugboat we sunk in 2021, you know, that had an engine, that had oil and all that. So that's a much more cumbersome process. All the fluids have to come out. And things you don't think about, like wire, like boats like that have like miles of wire in it, and they have insulation that potentially is hazardous. We take all that out, and essentially, yeah, you're left with a bare husk before it goes out.
So where does the funding come? I mean, it must be enormously expensive.
It can be, and we have to be incredibly creative, and Quint kind of hinted at it. We're always trying to county support to do these things, and unfortunately, at a local Duval County and other local Northeast Florida counties, we haven't had much support fiscally, so we have to get creative. A lot of the projects have been done locally, have been done with a lot of in-kind. So in this case, the barge was kind of provided by a company called Mobo Marine. We came up with a little bit of money for transport and some overhead, but most of our projects are like that, where we'll find something, maybe whoever has the material will provide it or help with transport. Maybe we get some help on the offshore transportation. Some local groups may help with a little bit of fiscal contribution here and there, but it's always very tough. And I mentioned to you in an email that we've done probably about 10 offshore projects over the last 10 to 13 years or so. And we're proud of those projects. But if you compare the numbers that we've done versus other counties, I'll use Daytona as an example. Daytona's probably done 150 artificial reefs in the same time period alone. And it's primarily because they have resources dedicated to those programs from the county level, where we just don't have that here.
Yeah, locally we rely on finding primarily state funding and donations from other corporations. But this is really where it'd be nice if the county stepped up and the city stepped up to provide some funding and some control, because, as you mentioned, Joe's done a great job of coordinating all the permitting and all this kind of stuff. It's not a simple process.
So he's talking about the number of projects that, you know, he's seen over the last 13 or so years. But if we could peel back the ocean, I mean, what would we see in terms of the total picture of what's been placed basically off the first coast area?
Well, part of the problem is that nature is a very unforgiving environment. And so if you put something down 20 years ago, it's probably not there anymore because it erodes, it corrodes, it goes away in other ways. And so it takes a sort of a continual process to maintain these and can keep it going. And so that's why it's necessary to do it again and again and again. We have very, very good offshore fishing in Jacksonville. Much of that is due to a people that did this literally in the 40s and 50s and 60s. And we've been lucky that Joe sort of picked up the gauntlet here and continued doing this locally, but he could use some help.
There is an element, not just of, you know, when they degrade, but also maintaining these reefs. You had mentioned that, you know, you put them down, they do draw fishermen, for instance, and that can create a problem of its own. So explain what that looks like and how you and others that you work with try to prevent that from becoming a pollution problem.
Sure. So we really need to think of a reef as an offshore destination. That's what it is. It's similar in regards to usage as, say, something like our football stadium. Anything that's on land that's a public destination has some sort of maintenance program, obviously. So if you went to a football game and there was no maintenance crew that came afterwards, it would be filthy. And so a byproduct of people using something is leftovers of whatever it is. What happens in the case of artificial reefs, natural reefs, anywhere that people go fishing in or diving, is it's not like you have people out there initially throwing trash in the water. Our fishermen are pretty respectable, the ones I know at least, and they don't do things like that. What does happen is when you fish, you may catch a fish and you get snagged on the reef. And so a little bit of line will break off. That's not a big deal. It's 5-10 feet of line. The problem is that's happened as long as boats have been able to get out there. So in some cases, 30, 40 years, we have accumulation of 10 feet of line, 10 feet of line, 10 feet of line every weekend. And so we end up with miles and miles and miles of fishing line in some of these structures. And that's generally not a good thing. It's an entanglement hazard and those kind of things. So in addition to creating reefs, you know, what we try to propose to the county to when we're getting more support for this kind of thing is we need to look at resources to create reefs, resources to also maintain our reefs, and actually resources to do outreach for things like these are the reefs we have, these are why they're important, these are why we need to maintain them. And effectively, it requires the logistics is people going down and removing this stuff. And it's not too hard. You got to be competent diver to do so, but you just kind of cut the line and bring it up. And the good news is you can reverse 30 years of accumulation in maybe one or two dives. So it's very effective.
And so is that something that's regularly scheduled or just kind of on an as-needed basis if you're down there and you see that it's getting a little bit polluted?
It is needed. We've done it kind of voluntarily occasionally when we can. I was just talking to a dive operator yesterday. We're trying to schedule some stuff this summer. There's no county structure or anything. It's just us doing it because we dive and we know. And like I said, we can be very effective, which is a handful of divers on each dive site. The problem is there's a lot of sites. And so, you know, it's great. Everyone we do is great, but really it needs to be scaled up and, you know, to be as effective as it can be.
Yeah, this is largely a volunteer effort by sometimes scuba clubs and organizations, people who have sort of banded together and do it periodically, but there's no organized effort. And that's where I think some county assistants could come in trying to organize these kinds of things.
And there have been some creations in the river as well. Is that true?
That's right. We've actually put two reefs in the river, and they were pretty successful. And we'd like to look for some additional sites. In fact, we've begun doing that already. One of the things we learned about the two reefs in the river, which were off of San Marco, just south of the Fuller Warren Bridge, was that we needed to be closer to the mouth with higher salinity. And the trick there is you've got to find a bottom that will support it, because you cannot put it in a soft mud bottom. It'll sink into the mud. And you cannot put it too shallow, because you don't want it to be a navigation hazard. So trying to find a spot is really, really hard. And I've spent a fair amount of time just staring at maps trying to figure out where we might be able to do something, and going out and sampling with some people trying to figure out what we might be able to do.
And Joe, we should say that you film in extensively these sinkings. You put cameras all over the place, then, you know, kind of create a video of the entire process. This barge sinking, we have a link to it on our website and on our social media, so people can check it out. But it's got 300,000 views already, and it really is quite a spectacle.
Yeah, it's and a big part of my background is kind of outreach, and I'm obviously biasly passionate about what we do. So I think it's just as important to get the message out as to build a reef itself. So I at least personally take every effort I can to document the projects and to try to showcase them in a way that's engaging and to educate at the same time. So what's neat when we do something like a vessel is it provides an opportunity for sink camera footage. And it's a kind of a neat, engaging way to get people interested. Because even if you don't know anything about, say, artificial reefs or even marine conservation, a lot of times the average person may see that type of footage and it will get them to become more engaged with the video and then hopefully get a little bit educated and then maybe be a little bit more conservation minded down the road.
Well, Joe Kistel, Dr. Quint White, thank you both so much for being here and talking about this really neat project.
It's pretty cool.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Up next, a new program launches doctoral hopefuls into cyberspace.
Mayo Clinic, working to predict the unpredictable by using a patient's anatomy to create 3D printed life-size organ models to map out complex surgeries. More at mayoclinic.org/Florida.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Each week on The Middle, we're focused on getting away from the extremes and listening to different perspectives. On our next show, is money corrupting our politics? One of our guests is the former Attorney General of Arizona, who got a new law passed in the state to reveal so-called dark money donors. Plus, your calls next time on The Middle.
Tonight at 9, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm David Folkenflik. MLB will pay tribute to the Negro Leagues at America's oldest professional ballpark. It's not Fenway Park or Wrigley Field. It's the historic Rickwood Field in Alabama, home to the Birmingham Black Barons. The Giants and Cardinals will play the first regular season baseball game there. Next time on Here and Now.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
Mayors get stuff done. For most of us, there are boots on the ground.
People got to be able to say, my life is better because of what happened in City Hall.
They work to improve transportation like electric vehicle chargers, water systems, and much more. We speak to mayors across the country about how they're sharing their plans to help us work, rest, and play. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. As artificial intelligence and cybersecurity threats ramp up, the need for computing experts has dramatically increased. A new program at the University of North Florida aims to meet that need. To discuss it, I'm joined now by Dr. William Klostermeyer, Dean of the school's College of Computing Engineering and Construction. Welcome, Chip.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. So UNF just announced this PhD program, its first PhD program. What is the significance of that, and why is it being unveiled now?
Right. So this is our first PhD program at UNF in the school's history, and it really represents an important step in the evolution of UNF, as a university, as a comprehensive university, as a research university. We think it's also a great step for Jacksonville, because it's really the first PhD to be offered by any of the schools in the region. In terms of why now, our strategic plan, the university has just approved this year, really wants us to improve our research efforts, improve our connections with the community. And there's so much, going on in computer science worldwide, as well as in the Northeast Florida region. We really think it's a great time to launch a traditional doctoral research program to help the region, the community, and UNF grow.
And so UNF has had doctoral level programs in some other areas, for medicine, I believe. Is that right? And
in nursing, in education, okay. And physical therapy. Yes.
But this is the first PhD program. So this really is a feather in the school's cap, I guess.
Right. This is a traditional research PhD, not an education doctorate or a clinical doctorate. So this is really a feather in our cap to be able to establish this.
So it seems like most of the stories around computing today are negative, really. There's, stories of hacking and cyber warfare, deep fakes, concerns about global security, personal privacy. How does this PhD program fit into addressing those concerns? And do you consider it kind of a positive field to be in? It seems like there's so much negativity around it.
Oh, that's a really good question. I think, as the bad actors sort of get more sophisticated, and you mentioned how they're doing it, I think the good actors, we need to keep up with the education and produce as many good actors who are going to be able to combat, harden our systems, have cybersecurity tools, artificial intelligence tools that are going to make us safer and more productive and more efficient in our lives, and hopefully combat the bad actors that unfortunately are out there.
And so this degree has sort of two concentration options, intelligent systems and cybersecurity. Explain to us what those are, what people who are interested in those two things, like how those might differ.
Right. So intelligent systems you can think of as being artificial intelligence. It could also include areas like algorithms, robotics. And those are things, we have plenty of folks working in the Jacksonville area that are doing things like that. You can think about fraud detection with with credit cards. That's something that, you know, Bank of Montreal has located their fraud detection headquarters here. You can think about, we've had partnerships with Mayo Clinic on detecting cancer from x-rays. So those are really important practical problems that we want to be able to educate students, have our faculty work on problems that are important in that sort of artificial intelligence area. And then the second focus of the program is cybersecurity, and that sort of speaks for itself. We need to train people to go into industry, into academia, just educate, strengthen our faculty's research on areas of cybersecurity. And that, you know, that touches everything we do, and, you know, nowadays. So we really thought it was important to focus on areas that were really going to touch lives, going to touch industry, and be really impactful.
And explain to us, what is the difference between computing and what we think of as just computer science?
Right. Computing. So we have a School of Computing here at UNF, and that's really just a broader term that encompasses computer science, encompasses data science, data analytics, information sciences. So it's really just a broader term we use umbrella term to cover all those areas.
So how big is the first class going to be? What do you expect it to look like in a couple of years? And are
we're
you still
hoping,
accepting
yes.
people?
So it takes a while to sort of get a new program going at any level. So we're hoping we can have, once we get it established, you know, 30 or 40 students in the program at a time. Some of the students may be part-time students, some will be going full-time. So we want to have a range of options available. We're hoping to have a really nice cohort of strong students who we can then send out into the community to really be the next step of Jacksonville's sort of research and intellectual life.
And are you still taking applications for like the fall of 2024?
Yes, students can apply for this any semester, whether it's in the fall, whether it's in the spring and summer terms. I had two former students already reach out to us this week once the announcement came out. So glad to see it's getting some interest from our former students.
Well, congrats on the new program. Dr. William Chip Klostermeyer, thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. And we're going to listen to a song now. The Trineers are going to close us out with their tribute to the great Willie Mays. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
That giant kid is great. When he hits the ball, it's long gone, man. Hits it farther than camp began. Swings the bat like a little lead pipe. When they reach the ball, it's overripe. Say hey,
say who?
Say Willie. Say hey,
say who?
Swing it at the plate. Say hey,
say who?
Say
a choo-choo train, swings around the second like an aeroplane. His cap flies off when it passes third, and he heads home like an eagle bird.
Say hey,
say who?
Say Willie. Say hey,
say who?
Swinging at the plate. Say hey,
say who?
Say Willie. That giant kid is great. Yes, he covers center like he had jet shoes. The other batters.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.